our speaker, Garnet. He came to me, I just to confess. Don't worry, it's a minor confession. You can all hear. I'm filling in as a pinch hitter this year, and so I did not ask Garnet until relatively recently. And what I did, though, I hadn't met Garnet before, and so I had asked around some people and got some people who I trusted their judgment. So people I can blame if it goes terribly wrong, fallback. Heard about Garnet, and I knew him through other people. I'd heard him, people in my home group had gone and had talked to him about attending his step studies, and so I knew him, and so I decided to check him out. And on the little bit I heard from him, it was really good. So I won't set you up too high. We'll keep expectations low. But without any more of my introduction, Garnet.
Thank you. My name is Garnet, and I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, it's 3 weeks ago. I just want to tell you that 3 weeks ago, I got up on Wednesday morning, and I'm thinking I'm going to get a hold of Barb back there, and I'm going to ask her if I can go to an Al-Anon, open Al-Anon meeting. I've never been to an open Al-Anon meeting. I've never been to an Al-Anon meeting, and I've never spoken at an Al-Anon conference or anything like that. That night, I went to my meeting. And Marty was there, and he said, "Will you speak at this meeting?" These are God incidents in my life, and I've been excited ever since then, you know, on what to do. I'm quite nervous, actually, quite nervous. But thank you for the opportunity and the theme, Come to Believe. That happened to me from the first moment I asked for help. I started to believe, and I had to change my whole way of believing. Everything had to change, and it was all for the better. I thoroughly enjoyed what I heard this morning. I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking, you're telling part of my story. You Al-Anon gals are stealing part of my story. You AA people are stealing part of my story. And I guess the reason for that is we're talking about the illness of alcoholism. The illness of alcoholism, the symptoms are the same all over the world. They're no difference, you know. And so we act the same no matter where we are. This afternoon, they're having meetings all over the world, in 168 countries, and they're talking about what we're going to talk about this afternoon. And there's Al-Anon meetings tonight. They're going to talk about what you're going to talk about at your meetings. So this is big. This is big. And it's way bigger than any one of us. And it took me a little while to realize that you know, I'm a grain of sand on a beach here, really. And so I want to share some of my experiences and strengths and hopes with you. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous drunk on July the 9th, 1966. So that's just over 48 years ago. It may seem like a long time, but I'd have been dead that night if I would not have come. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, a practicing Satanist, and I got a kick out of Dave this afternoon when he said I was an agnostic and I thought God hated me. By gosh, by the time I worked myself up to being an agnostic, I knew God loved me. So we can come from all backgrounds. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, as I said, drunk. Okay, but I want to go back. Where did I come from? What kind of a family? I'm the one that doesn't believe that alcoholism is hereditary, and so what if it is? It don't matter. You know, Al-Anon know more about alcoholism than AA people do. All we need to know is that I got it. Let's do something about it. I should not worry myself and get into the debate whether it's hereditary, scientific, or whatever the heck it is. I mean, I got it. If I got a sore tooth, I don't go to the argue for 3 or 4 days. I go and get it pulled or fixed, you know. I know what's wrong. I got a sore tooth. But I come from a family where there's very little alcoholism. I have my mom and dad come from big families. And there's one uncle that drank a little too much. I have no aunts that had a drinking problem. I have no uncles that had drinking problems. And I have a few cousins, but I was looking the other day at the names, and there's a whole bunch of them. They didn't get into problems with alcohol. I'm an alcoholic because I am an alcoholic. And so my mom and dad, I come from a very poor family. We were raised in a very spiritual home, not religious, but a spiritual home. And I was uncomfortable in my skin from a little kid, right from on. I can remember looking back at my life. I was uncomfortable as a little boy growing up in a community. I'm dark. I come from a community surrounded by a bunch of Swedes and Norwegians, and they're all white people. I'm part native, you know, so I got the nice Mexican complexion, you know, and we're okay with that. But that bothered me when I was younger. I grew up in this little community, went to school, finished my high school, and I started drinking in about grade 10. I remember in grade 11, a counselor coming to the school, or whoever they were, come out, and they pointed me out as probably a potential alcoholic, because the teachers had talked to them. And my answer or questions to her or statement to her was, you start buying my booze, you tell me how much I can drink, and until then, mind your own business. See, I was in denial right from then. I did not know what was wrong. I finished school, and I'll tell you, you don't get smarter when you drink. I wrote my grade 12 exams and failed half of them, but I was drunk right in my grade 12 exams, and I thought I was going to pass them and get extra big marks, you know. And then I went out working, and I worked as a prospector. And I went up into northern Canada. And northern Canada, to me, is like 500-600 miles north of Churchill and up in the way up in the Arctic and all over there. And then in the north of Quebec, Ontario, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. And I'd done exploration work for a company called International Nickel Company. And I spent about 9 years in and out of that. And that's where I drank. I got comfortable up there, and I drank with the men and played with the men and worked with the men. And I took my little things with me, and I didn't know what it was. But I found out that drinking done a lot for me. And anything I know about alcohol or drinking, I learned from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous since I got to AA. And, you know, I loved drinking. I liked what it done. And it tells me in my big book that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I drank for the effect. I never, ever drank for the result. I didn't drink to get a lick, and I didn't drink to get arrested. I didn't drink to smash my cars up. I drank for the effect it made me feel good. It done something for me. Now, I look back on that and say, if booze done that for me, before I drank, there must have been a problem. Why would something change in me where I'd be more comfortable and feel better if there wasn't something wrong before I took my first drink? And so I become obsessed. And in our book, it talks about the obsession and the compulsion. So I become obsessed with this feeling. I want to become obsessed with alcohol because it done something for me. It gave me something. Alcohol was an answer to my problems. I couldn't define the problem. But later on, my answer became my problem, which was alcohol. Okay, but it took a period of years. So I become obsessed with this booze. And the obsession was there too, you know, obsessed with it, and then the compulsion. So I have an illness, which is an obsession of the mind and a compulsion, a physical compulsion. So that when I started drinking, I didn't know when I was going to quit. Or I would drink on occasions which I had no plan to drink. My grandparents had a 60th wedding anniversary. My two sisters had a double wedding. It was a big celebration. They sat me down a year before their wedding and said, Garnet, would you be our best man? There's only three of us, my sisters and me. I said, oh, yeah. They said, but you cannot drink. And I promised them as honestly as I could, I would not drink. So I went away and I worked for 6 or 7 months, and I come back 3 days before the wedding, and I didn't drink the first day. I didn't drink the second day. And about 2, you know, the wedding's at 2, and at 10 o'clock in the morning, a lady come by and said, Garnet, I got a bottle of wine. Do you want a shot? I said, one wouldn't hurt. You know, I ended up screwing that wedding up. I lost my shoes. I lost the keys, or the keys. I lost the wedding rings. I went and put them on my fingers. I was also given the rings on this. I have them on my fingers, and I can't find them. And this preacher is saying, give me the rings. Pass me the rings. And I'm searching for them in my suit pockets and all over. I said, I can't find them. And I pulled my car keys out, reached for them and got them out. And I said, and loud enough for everybody here, bless these damn things until I find the keys. And I said, oh, there they are. They're on my finger. And I said, but you're going to have to bless my keys before I give you the rings. So he done a quick little whatever he'd done. And you know, my sisters cried at that wedding. They were ashamed of me. So was my parents. And I spoiled that whole evening. Not for them. I got drunk enough to pass out and go and sleep in the ditch somewhere. But, you know, I had honestly promised them. And I knew, and my grandparents, I promised them. So this is a compulsion. It was beyond my ability to handle it. The obsession and the compulsion is not, it's not something I can handle. It's bigger than me. It's in my mind. And so when I got into this program and they said I had to accept step one, I have never had 2 seconds problem with accepting the fact that I am powerless over alcohol, okay? I am powerless over the illness of alcohol. And I'm going to call it an illness, and just for some people say disease. I know you have a book in Al-Anon says the disease of alcoholism. There's nowhere in our books can you find the word disease. It's all illness, the illness, okay? So I call it the illness. And so I had no problem accepting this fact that I have this illness, mental illness, the obsession and compulsion, which I have no power over. I can't do anything about it, nor can anyone else. That obsession must be taken away from me through the power of God, okay? And so I had no problem there. But, you know, my life, while I was drinking, I become a very a different person. I didn't grow up to be a bad person, but I become a bad person. I became a very violent man. I was full of hate. I struck out at people to hurt them and to hurt them bad. I ran with people that we carried guns and we shot at people and we used knives and we hurt people and we hurt them badly. I watched people die. I watched 2 of my friends committing suicide by drowning. And my only feelings were when I seen them drown was, man, you're lucky. I had no feelings left in me by the age of 19, 20 years old, you know. Life wasn't anything. And when I would get mad, if I was mad at you, and there'd come a point where all you'd do is turn into a red glob. There was no feature there, just a red. Some call blackouts, I call them a red out. And when that happened, I would attack. I would attack that with everything I had in me. I was trained in martial arts at that time, and I could hurt people fast and hard. And this one night at a dance, I want to tell you 2 or 3 incidents. One night at a dance, I'm getting in a scrap with a couple of guys, and I love to fight for some reason. I got in the scrap, and the third person, they all turned red, and the third face come in the middle. And I reached out, and I grabbed that third one by the throat. And I had a broken beer bottle behind me, which I picked up, and I went after the eyes, and I struck 3 times for the eyes. And I remember it was 3, because it was 1, 2, 3. I was going to cut the face out of this person. I never did hit that person. But when my eyes cleared, I had my mother by the throat, and I was driving a broken beer bottle into her face. And my eyes cleared, and I just dropped everything and stopped. And she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm getting even for Dad. These guys were talking about Dad. And she took me for a little walk, and I cried, and I said, I'm sorry, and all that. But I didn't know who I'd picked on when I picked on my mother. And 2 days later, I went home, and my dad met me at the door, and he says, boy, he said, what you done to your mother last night, you scared her. There's no reason for that. You have shamed us over the years. I was 21, 22 at this time. You have shamed us. You have taken away any faith that we had in you. You're an animal. You come home and the people are around here talking about you after the cops are out looking for you for things that you've done. He said, I'm ashamed of you. We don't want, Mom and I have talked. Please do not ever call us Mom and Dad again. Don't ever come home again. And please don't ever use your last name. And we will never claim you as a son. Goodbye. And he turned his back on me. And, you know, I just lost the 2 things that I loved the most in my life, my mother and dad. And I lost any pride, any dignity, anything going. And I made a decision at that point that I would die and that you were going to kill me. I wasn't going to do it myself. I tried the suicide trip once or twice and going over a period of time. I tried going under the back wheels of semi-trailers and missing because the trucks were going faster than I estimated. And then you feel like a fool shoveling yourself out of the ditch in the snowbank, you know, and somebody say, what happened? I just slipped off the road. They pull you out then, you know. I tried shooting myself. I stuck a gun in my mouth, and I pulled the trigger, and it didn't go off. I took it out of my mouth and thought there was something wrong with my gun, and I pulled the trigger, and it went off, and I got scared because, you know what, I just about shot me. You know? I went to drown myself one time, and I learned how to swim. I dog paddled to shore. You know, what feeble attempts, but the attempts was there. I wanted to die starting at 19 years old, but I never told anybody about it because I didn't know what was wrong, okay? The gangs I run with, they're all basically, a lot of them are dead. They got shot by policemen. It wasn't a good scene. I lived in the city here from 61, 62, 63. I was a king down on 20th Street in those years, you know. Walked and done the work on the streets there. Life just carried on like that. I'd done a lot of it. I never was unemployed when I drank. That's the other thing. And then one day, and I'm going to skip ahead, there's another time I got in a car accident. I want to tell you about my mom and dad. I got in a car accident. I crippled people up in it. There was a death. People were cut up pretty badly. And I got charged. And I hired a lawyer by the name of Klein Harrodance in Prince Albert. And he said, you need a good lawyer, Garner. I said, well, I hope I got one. So I told him what happened. He said, this isn't a bad case. We'll, you know, I think we'll get you off. Then he called me in. He said, we got seven witnesses. And he said, what he told me was, if you know these people, go out and tell them, come and talk to me. I'd like to talk to them, too. They've already talked to the cops. That's what he said. But I heard him say, Garnet, go out and talk to these guys and tell them not to be witnesses. So I went out and I threatened their lives. And he called me back in 3 or 4 days later and he said, Garnet, we need to talk to you. Okay, come in. And he picked up the file and he threw it at me and his words, what in the hell did you do now? I said, why? He said, these are Crown's witnesses. These are the Crown's witness. And you went and threatened them with their lives. And he said, now you're being charged with tampering with justice and it's an automatic 10 years in prison. So you're going to prison for 10 years. I said, okay, that was 18 months before I sobered up. So I took to drinking a little bit harder, you know. And so that happened to me. During this period of time, I don't know how many of you people have ever been up at Lac La Ronge, but I had such a nice reputation. I was such a decent fellow. When I moved up to La Ronge, I was curling with in the wintertime, I was curling with the doctor and the mayor and the head of the RCMP up there. In July, I was run out of town as an undesirable by the RCMP and the mayor, you know. And that's how fast things change. I wasn't welcomed anywhere. So life just kept on. I just want to go through fairly quick here. Life kept on. And then one day I'm sitting at home, and I come from a little town called McDowell. I'm sitting at home, and a buddy come up to me, the same guy that gave me my first bottle of beer at a dance. And I remember when Wally gave me that bottle of beer at the dance, I drank it and I went back in and I felt different. You know, the girls would dance with me. I didn't have two left feet. I enjoyed myself. I remember going back 2 weeks later we used to have little country dances, you fellows that are, you know, a little older. 2 weeks later and I'm scared. I'm that scared little boy again. I'm standing back. I can't go and dance. I can't ask the girls to dance, blah, 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 all that. I'm not fitting in. And Wally come up and he said, I got two more bottles of beer. I'll sell them to you. So I bought them. And I drank a bottle of beer, and I'm not getting drunk, but I walked back in, and everything had changed. I become comfortable, and I fit in. I was obsessed with what booze could do with me after that, and I think that's where I became alcoholic at that time. So this one day, years later, I'm sitting in front of a beer parlor in McDowell, and Walter drives up. And he says, what are you doing? And I said, I have to go to Prince Albert and see my lawyer. Jump in. I'll drive you in. I was going to wait for a bus, I told him. I drove in, and I made a mistake. I said to Wally, how are you doing? Oh, he said, real good now. And he started talking about his life. He didn't drink anymore. And he talked about loneliness and fear and shame and guilt and remorse and hate and losing his family and having to go to court and losing a job and living with his mom and his family and, you know, his daughter and wife leaving him and the shame and all of that stuff. And I understood that. I could feel that. I was feeling the same shame as he was. And then he said, you know, 6 months ago, two guys come and see me. And they talked about what I'm talking about. And they start taking me to a meeting, and I haven't had a drink for 6 months. And he said, Garnet, you know, if you're feeling any of this, you could come too. I said, well, where did you go? And he said, Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, you bunch of gutless, spineless. You have to go somewhere to quit drinking. I quit every so often. You know? I do okay. You know, and he kept talking to me. I did not know one person that ever stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never knew anybody. I knew two people other than him that used to say they're in AA, but used to get drunk all the time. And I thought, I don't need to go to a course to do that. I do that quite well by myself, you know. So we kept talking, and then Wally said, was talking to me. We were getting right into Prince Albert, and he said, you know, Garnet, if somebody ever needs help, and you're living in Thompson, Manitoba, he said, you go to the police, a preacher, a bartender, and you ask them where Alcoholics Anonymous is, and they'll tell you. And I said, Wally, why are you telling me this? And he looked at me, and thank God for Wally's honesty, he looked at me and he said, because Garnet, my friend, you are alcoholic. And I'd never been called an alcoholic before, but something happened. I had an identity, and I was so much in denial, I just smashed his nose all over his face and got out of his car and walked away from him, but I never forgot what he said. I am alcoholic. He'd explained to me, the obsession and the compulsion, and I couldn't deny it. And he called me the alcoholic. And you see, an alcoholic, I understand, as long as you don't confront him, he can hide behind this key. You don't tell me I've got a drinking problem, you don't see me. He told me I had a drinking problem, he left me standing absolutely naked, and the only way I could deal with that was come after him. Yeah, I drank for 3 more months. I'm sitting in the beer parlor in Thompson, and I was drinking all afternoon. I'm sitting there, and it's early. It's 10 minutes to 8, and or 10 minutes to 7, I guess it was. And they closed the beer parlors. Remember those days? They used to shut the beer parlors down at supper time, okay? Well, they shut them down up there, too. And I'm sitting there ready to go into the beer parlor, and I rapped on the door, and I used to be a bartender or beer slinger in there. And the bartender come up and said, Garnet, get out of here, you bum. We don't need you anymore. Holy Christ, that hurt. And I'm standing there, and it's 5 minutes to go. And I heard a voice, and that voice come to me as loud as my voice is to me right now. And it said, Garnet, why? Why can't you go home? Why do your mom and dad disown you? Why are you in trouble with the law? Why are you going to prison for like 10 years? Why did a person die because of your uselessness, your way? Why do you feel okay when some of your friends commit suicide? Why don't you have any money? Why? And I ran out of answers that night. I couldn't answer that question in my mind as to why. And I decided that I'd do something. And I remembered Wally saying, Garnet, if you ever need help, you know, there's ads in the newspapers, too. And I'd read those ads up in Thompson in the newspapers. So I went to read the newspaper, and you turkeys and Alcoholics Anonymous did not put the ad in that night. I hated you with every ounce I had in me. If I could have found an AA member, I'd have killed him. I want help now. And, you know, you're a society that only takes in so many members and you quit. It's July and you took the summer off or something. I didn't have a clue. I need help, and you let me down. And I'm standing there, and then I remembered watching my buddy commit suicide and how lucky he was, and I started for the river. And I walked out of the hotel in Thompson, and the river was 20 minutes away because I walked many times with a case of beer down to sit and drink at the river. And my buddy Sandy had committed suicide there a year before, one guy up in La Ronge. And I started out for the river. I'm a practicing Satanist. I do not believe in prayer. That happened from way back. And I'm going down the street, and I heard somebody say, help. I looked around. I'm the only guy on the street. And it was out loud. I said, help. The most powerful word I've ever said in my life up till then. I walked from here to the back of this hall, and I turned. I was turned into a bookstore, confectionery store I'd never been in. And I looked around, and it was full of people, and I walked up to a man I'd never seen before, kind of bald-headed, heavy set, with that smile. And I walked up to him, and he said, can I help you? Just like he had heard me. And I didn't say, can you give me a ride to the river? It's a 20-minute walk. Can you rush me down there so I can commit suicide? The words came out of my mouth, where can I find AA? Friends, that's not what I was thinking. That's what I asked. And he stuck out his hand. And he said, if you want it, I'll give it to you. And I had food on me. I smelled like a rat. And he stuck out his hand. He said, if you want it, I'll give it to you. Come with me. found out later he owned that store. We walked down into the pool room, and I'm standing there, and he walked down, and he gave a yell, and about five guys come walking over at their pool cues, and I immediately put my back against the wall. I'd been in those pool room fights. You don't have a pool stick, you're in trouble, you know. I backed against the wall, and they all come over and sat down and introduced themselves. And then they done a 12-step call on me. They said, come on, we're going to a house. And I went over to this house, and they started talking to me, and they talked about, and they laughed about the stupidest things. They laughed about going to jail. There's nothing funny when you're looking at 10 years. They laughed about losing their family. There's nothing funny when your parents have disowned you. They laughed about being broke. They laughed about being sick. They laughed and laughed about stuff that there was nothing funny about it. And I'm screaming inside of myself, God, don't you know what's wrong with me? But as I walked into that house, Old Duke was his name, he said, Garnet, do you know the Lord's Prayer? I said, no. He said, before you leave this house, you'll get on your knees and say it with me at the steps. I walked in, and I listened to these guys, but I started making up Lord's Prayers. There was lots of them. You know, now lay me down to sleep, our Father who art in heaven, four corners in my bed, blah, 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 blah. I did not know the Lord's Prayer at 27 years old. I couldn't say it. So they talked to me, and it's time to go home, and we walked to the door to leave, and Duke says to me, Garnet, he said, we'll just stop here. And he looked at me, and he said, do you know it? I said, no, I don't. He said, that's okay. I wouldn't embarrass you. I'll kneel down and say it for you. And he did. And he said, now you can walk home. Walked outside, a nice starlight night. And he said, I want you to walk home now, and I want you to look at the stars. So there goes old dummy walking home looking at the stars. But before I left, he said, come and see me tomorrow morning. Come to my office and see me. So I went up there and go back in, and he said, my landlady, I'd robbed her. She was about the size of that little lady that come up here this afternoon, your wife. You know, I was, oh, cripes, that was tough, you know. I could take money from her anytime. And I give her $10 back, and she said, well, didn't you use it? I said, no, I joined AA last night. I'm not going to drink again. Oh, she said, that's nice. This is a good deal. I went and seen him, and he said, have you got any questions? And I said, yeah. Why did I have to walk home looking at the stars? He said, if you do the three things you done last night, you will never walk with your head down again. You'll never have to take another drink. He said, you ask for help. You talk to people like yourself, and you prayed. I said, I did not pray. He said, shut up. Yeah. And he repeated it. He said, you asked for help to God, and I answered. He said, you talk to a whole bunch of people like yourself, and you prayed while you're in that room. And he said, you do a few more simple things in life that we're going to tell you. You'll never have to drink again. I've never wanted to take a drink from that night. I didn't realize it, but I was starting to come to believe that there was something out there. Okay. And so I went to a few meetings up there after that. And then a buddy of mine drowned himself on the 15th of July. I went looking for him. A few days later, I was walking the shoreline to see if his body was floating, and I slipped on rocks and broke my knee, and then I had to come back to Prince Albert. And they gave me a list of names of people to contact in Prince Albert. And one of them was Jack C. from Prince Albert. He's my sponsor. He's my first sponsor. Last Tuesday, we celebrated his 54th birthday, AA birthday, and the Sunday was his 92nd birthday. And the man is just lovely, and he's sitting there wondering, you know, telling me, I told him I was going to do this. He said, well, don't forget, keep it simple, stupid. Use the kiss thing, you know. So I come to Prince Albert, and I was crippled, and I met these people in AA. Things started happening in Prince Albert. Not so much, I got dry up north there for a while. And I got into Prince Albert and in the old Starlight group. And I'd go in there for a little while, and all of a sudden they said to me, Garnet, we have to have a meeting with you. And I said, okay. So they were talking about sponsorship. And they explained sponsorship to me. And for you people, why do you need a sponsor? I'm going to explain it the way it's explained to me. You are running the biggest business in the world, your life. Whether you're in Al-Anon or AA, you're running the biggest business in the world, your life, the gift from God. Okay. A successful business person has advisors, has consultants, and always has somebody smarter than they are in every area that they hire these people. That's why they hire lawyers. That's why they hire, you know, whatever you have. So they said, we are going to be your consultants. We're going to be your sponsors in these areas. And Jack, the guy I went to visit, he said to me, I'm going to be your service sponsor. I'm going to show you how to, because the guy was really active in the community and he was a delegate at the time. He said, so I'm going to show you how to do service in your community and start fitting back into the community that you rejected. I'm going to show you how to do service in Alcoholics Anonymous so they'll start building up some trust for you. And he was my service sponsor. Then Max said, I'm going to be your business sponsor. Max was a very successful businessman. And he had several stores and very successful, very well known, highly respected. He was one of the mentors to John Diefenbaker. I mean, he had people in big places and he was advising a lot of people, you know, some of the higher ups in the country at that time. And he said, so I'm going to teach you the difference between your needs and your wants. And I there's a lot of things I want, but I need very little. I need very little. So he said, anything over $25, he said, if you're going to buy it, you have to sleep on it for 24 hours. Anything over $50, you're going to sleep on it for 2 nights. Then you're going to sit down and figure out whether you need it or want it. And if you need it, you're going to come and tell me why you need it. And so he taught me the difference between my needs and wants and how to work with business. Then Big Glenn spoke up, and he said, I'm going to be your big book sponsor, and I'm going to be your spiritual sponsor. I said, okay. So Glenn started with the big book. Big Glenn was a 320 pounds, 6'3", amateur wrestler, chiropractor, and a kind of an amateur boxer. Just the kind of a guy I needed, you know. Yeah. And he didn't pull any punches. I caught a few. And so he said, this is what I'll do. And he started teaching me, he's going to teach me the book. Harold MacDonald said, you are pretty abusive with women. I'm going to teach you how to be a decent gentleman with women. And you're going to work through the program. And Hartley, he said, I am going to be your ass kicker. I'm just going to check your motives and values and everything as you go through life. And we're going to work together and we're going to communicate with each other. And we're going to know how you're doing day by day by day. I thought that's how this thing worked. So I went along with it, you know. And we started doing this program. We started working. So the step one come along, as I said, I have never had any problem recognizing that the obsession and the compulsion is bigger than me. I need a power greater than myself to help me. That my life was unmanageable, no problem there. It tells me in my book that in the first part here, it says, we've recovered. And I remember Glenn, first of all, opening this book up, he says, we're going to get started. And he said, in the front part of the book, it said, this is a story how thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Not recovering, recovered. He said, is that what you want? Or I said, yeah. And he said, if you keep recovering, it's like taking an old chair to the upholster and you get it recovered and then you take it away and put it back so they keep recovering it. You'll never get around to using it. Do the 12 steps, get on with the business of living was his statement all the time. And then it says in the foreword to the first edition, where am I at here? That's the second. It says we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I began to recover from that hopeless state of mind and body, okay? I'm never cured of alcoholism. Don't mix the two words up, because you can't find the word recovering in this book. You'll say two places, but it'll always be recover or recovered, okay? Recovering comes from outside stuff, I think, you know? And why do we need this book? They told me, and it says, to show alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. There isn't another book on the market to show you how to recover from alcoholism, okay? And so that's how I got talked in here. And so step one come along, I had no problem with that. That my life had become unmanageable, yeah, this hopeless state of mind, and the more I drank, the worse it got. And I'd done stupid things when I was drinking because I was drinking, okay? And it got worse and worse as the hopelessness of my mind deteriorated, okay? And I become all these different guys. So in this step, it was very easy. Step one, The other thing Max sent to me, he said, well, 27 years old, boy. He said, you can't go home. You're going to prison. You haven't got a job. You got a broken leg. Nobody likes you. The only people who accept you is members of AA. Go and look in the mirror. You'd be an absolute idiot if you say that's success. And I thought of that. Yeah, that's not success. All my friends around me were getting married and doing things at 27 years old, but not me, you know. So then I come to the second step. It says in here, some of these we bucked, and then the promises, you know. I don't know how many, in the first 103 pages of this book, there's 151 promises. And we all talk about the 12 in step 9, you know, before we're halfway through. And people think, well, before we're halfway through what, the program? No, step 9, this is what happens. What about the step 3 problem, 4, 5, 6, you know, 4 and 5 and the rest of them? So we got going in a step 2, and I like what it said. Rarely, first promise I've seen in here, two of them, there is a solution. There is a solution. Boy, what a promise that was to me. And the next one, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed this path. That's quite a statement to make, you know. We all know there's whooping cranes out there. How many of you ever seen a whooping crane? Yeah, it's very rarely you see them, isn't it? But they're there. That's about how rare we see a person fail who thoroughly follows this path, you know. And that's the way I took it. That's the way I understood it. So we got into this step 2 where I came to believe. And I read that wrong. I thought, you know, I heard people talking. I thought it was came to believe in God. Came to believe in a power greater than myself. It's not what it said. It says, came to believe that I could be restored to, I had to change it a bit, came to believe that I could be restored to sanity by a power greater than myself. My power greater than myself started out to be my sponsors. That's all I believed in. And then I started believing in what they believed in, and I didn't like the word God. In fact, they used to talk about God, and I used to say, hey, the idiots that wrote that word were dyslexic. Spell it backwards, we're talking about a dog. And I'll tell you about my dog, and they say, shut up. You know? But I want to make speeches about my dog, because I was afraid. I was afraid. And then I got reading in here, and I don't know a lot of, all you guys know that read this book, but there's 73 pages to explain the 12 steps in this big book. You know, there's 73 pages in here explaining them. And the thing that I had, the insanity that I had to deal with was the insanity of taking that first drink. That's the insanity. What I've done after is, and I do the same thing over and over. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result, you know. And so that's the insanity. And I guess that hit me right off the bat because I've never wanted to take a drink from the day I said help, okay. That worked, but I had a whole lot of straightening out to do up here. This place is all buggered up. It was all mixed up, you know. And so we got doing that, and then I got arguing with Glenn. I said, there's no power greater than myself. See, I was a pretty tough guy. There's no power greater than myself. And we argued in his office for a couple hours. And we walked to his office, down to the club room. We used to have club rooms. He said, Garnet, open that door. So I opened the door, and I walked in. Now, this guy is a giant. Walked in, and he said, Garnet. And I said, what? I turned around, he hit me. And he knocked me down. He knocked me into a chair. And I got out, and I come back, and he hit me, and he knocked me down again. And I looked at him, and I said, why do you do that, Glenn? And he said, I want to show you there's a power greater than yourself. Yeah. And I said, Glenn, that's physical. And he picked me up, and he hugged me, and he cried. And he said, Garney, that's a start. That's a start. So if any of you are having trouble with this power greater than yourself, see me after the meeting. My sponsor, Glenn, was having trouble with a power greater than himself. And his sponsor, they were up at Waskasu, and they were golfing. And they were arguing about this. And Glenn bent over to put a ball on the tee. And Jake walked up behind him, and he kicked him where the sun don't shine, a little lower. And Glenn went on his face, and he asked the same question. And he said, I just want to show you there's a power greater than yourself. I like the way they used to do it. You know? Yeah. So this God thing, though, was really, you know, when I got into the step three, where I had to make a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God, as I understand him. Now, I don't have a clue what God is, and I still don't today. I don't look at God as in the form of a person. That makes it too small. I don't look at God as just, I look out here and I see God all over. There's electricity keeping these lights on. There's a microphone in front of me. There's your eyes. There's your life, you know. And I was arguing with this God. Who the heck is God? How do I turn my will and life over to him? My book tells me that I have to turn, there's 100 forms of fear, selfishness, self-centeredness, and anger that I've got to turn over, you know. And so I try to turn that over, and I still argue there's no such a thing as God. So Glenn says, I wanted you to go up out to an Indian reserve and talk to an elder. So I went out there, and I said to the old man, I said, Bill, what's God? He said, I don't know. And I remember thinking, well, thank God you don't know. You should, you know. But he started explaining. It was this time of the year, and he started explaining things to me. And he talked about the leaves falling off the trees and the water going to freeze. And he talked about the muskrat building bigger push-ups because it's going to be a longer winter. And the hair growing longer on the bear and the moose and all of that. And the ducks heading south and the geese heading south. And he said, they have a little wee brain, yet they're going. There's something doing this for them. He talked to me like 3 hours. Talked about the wind, the rain. And I looked at him and I said, but you know what, Bill, that's nature. He said, maybe that's part of what God is. I spent time up north sitting and looking at the northern lights, watching the stars. And so I come back and Glenn said to me, well, did you learn what God is? I said, oh, yeah, but he's so damn busy. He's got all those birds to get going, and he's got the blah. Oh, you know how many leaves are on the trees that he's got to get off? And on and on and on. So Glenn said, I want you to talk. I want you to do something. I want to share with you right now what my concept of God is. He said, I want you to do something, Garnet. And if you want to do it with me, do it. He said, do this. He said, what do you feel? I said, a heartbeat. He said, what have you got to do with that heartbeat? That heart was beating from just after conception. That heart was beating before you were born. And somebody talked about that this morning with their kids. Okay. That heart is beating before you were born. That heart was beating while you were hurting people, while you were sleeping, while you were passed out. You got nothing to do with that. Nothing. He said, and every insect, bird, and animal has received heartbeats since I started talking to you. He said, your lifespan is the distance between heartbeats. He said, so all we're doing is saying, why don't you turn your will and life over to the care of the power that just made your heartbeat? That to me is God. I don't hold hands in a meeting when I pray. I touch God. I pray like that because I want the physical impulse coming. That's as close as I can get, you know, and it works. And so that's my concept of God. Don't try to explain it. I had one guy say it's chemistry. Well, that's great, but who invented the chemistry? You know, yeah. So my concept, I have to keep it simple. I have no picture. I heard a man say, I can't draw a picture of God for you, you know. It's something too big. It's something too big. Count the hairs on your head and see how far you get. You know. The other thing he said, I want you to check in. God checks in with you 60 times, 65 times a minute. How would you like to check in 10, 12 times a day? Good balance. Because he said, just try holding that and say, I love you between heartbeats. You can't do it. God is too busy checking in with you for you to say anything. And it takes away a lot of selfishness and self-centeredness when I realize that. So that's what I've used, and that's what I've, you know, and I still use the same thing. The rest of the steps, you know, that's coming to believe. And what I'm trying to explain here is what happened to me. I'm an atheist now, probably. You know, I went from a Satanist to an atheist. Other things are starting to happen. Come along Thanksgiving Day, and Glenn said to me, Garnet, we're going to go out and see your mom and dad. I said, no, we're not. He said, we're going to go out and see your mom and dad. I didn't ask you. I'm telling you. So we got in his car, and I said, it's Thanksgiving. I can't do this. My mom and dad don't want to see me. I don't need to hurt them anymore. Glenn said, you're going out to see your mom and dad. So I went out there, and he stopped the car roughly about a half a block from the house. He said, get out and walk. Go knock on that door at 6 o'clock at night. I walked up to that house. I turned around. I come back. I said, Glenn, I can't do it. He said, I'm not asking you. I'm telling you. Go. So I went again, and I come back. And I said, Glenn, I just can't do it. He said, go, Garnet. It's going to be okay. And I'm halfway there, and I heard a car start. And I looked, and all I seen was the taillights. He was gone. I walked to that door, and I'd been at that door four or five times since the incident. And when I opened, knocked on my door, Dad used to come to the door, and he'd look at me and say, "What do you want?" And slam the door in my face, and I'd walk away. And I'd hurt so badly. I didn't want that rejection anymore. I realize that today. I knocked on the door, and Dad come to the door, and he looked at me, and he said, what do you want? And I said, Dad, I want to tell you I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I quit drinking in July. He turned his back on me. He turned around, and they were eating supper. And he says, "Mom, set another plate at the table. Our son has come home." Yeah. I guess I seen Al-Anon. My mother was not an Al-Anon, but I seen forgiveness that day, okay? And I seen acceptance. And I never, to the day that she died, did she ever bring that up to me again. That's God. I came to believe again. I was 18 months sober, and my lawyer called me in, and he's telling me I'm going to do 10 years in prison. He called me in, and he said, "We've been at court. Here's the situation." And I said, "Oh, my God. The situation is that you're going to get a stay of 9 years. And you're going to do it on two conditions. You're not going to drink, and you're not going to get in trouble. And the judge will consider a parking ticket trouble." I didn't do any time. He said, "The reason for that is your work with Alcoholics Anonymous and the people, and you're working with police and you're working with everybody else. You get into trouble, you're going to prison for 10 years. And it just irritates me when I hear these people getting these little short terms like 6 months probation and seven. You haven't got time to even get practicing it. Get 9 years. Man, you know what? I have two conditions in my life yet. Don't drink, don't get into trouble. And it works. It's so simple. It works. I'm not fighting this, you know. And so I had to come to believe. I was forced to come to believe. And that each step that I go through with takes me a little closer to making me believe more and more and more with each step. And in our 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening, a full belief in a power greater than ourselves. Come to believe, you know. And I fought that. And somewhere along the line, I sobered up firstly on fear of alcohol. And you cannot live being afraid of alcohol. You can't live with alcohol around. This book says that's all removed. By doing the steps, I eventually got instead of fear-based sobriety, I got faith-based sobriety. And it makes a big difference. I don't walk around looking behind me very much. I walk looking forward and upward. And that's faith. And you know, there's a guy was talking one day, and he said, "We all talk about how much faith and how much belief we have." He said, "But that's only two sides of the triangle. There's three sides to it." And he told me a story. He said, there's a guy down in the Grand Canyon, and he strung a big wire across there, and he's got a bicycle. And he said, "I'm going to, you know, have a bunch of people out. And here's this old boy with his sponsee standing there." And he said, "I'm going to ride the bike across the Grand Canyon." The old boy said to his sponsee, he says, "Do you believe he can do it? You got belief?" "Oh, yeah, I believe he can do that. You better believe it." He rode it back and forth. He says, "See, I told you I believed he could do it. He could do it." Then the guy says, "Now I'm going to ride the bike across there without the balancing pole." He said, "I have faith I can do it." And the sponsor said, "Do you have faith that he can do it?" "Yeah, I got faith." He goes and he does it, you know. And he comes back. "Oh," he said, "you got faith and belief. You still haven't got much, do you? We're talking about step three." He said, "Now," he said, "I'm going to take a wheelbarrow and push it across the canyon on me. Who's going to get in it?" He said, "Do you trust him?" And that's step three. Do you trust your God? Will you get in the wheelbarrow with him every day? Or are you going to be like I used to be? "Oh, I got faith and belief and chatter, but I'm not going to take much risk," you know. So I had to get in that wheelbarrow. And I wanted to jump out many times. And every time I jumped out, I got hurt, you know. I got hurt. So that faith thing is great. Belief is great. But put the three of them together, it makes a little difference when you're going to get in that wheelbarrow. Okay. The other thing I learned about the God I believe in is I don't beg him. I believe that when I ask God to do something to help me, I'm helped. I said one word, the biggest prayer I ever said, help. I'm still standing here as a result of that. I don't beg him to help me. I believe God will help you. And I don't ask twice for the same thing. It's like if I was going to come here and you were going to pick, told me 2 weeks ago you're going to pick me up, and I phoned you every day since then, are you sure you're going to pick me up? I don't trust you. That's what I'm doing. If I keep asking God for the same thing over and over, I think once I ask God to do something, I ask him again, and he'll say, what are you talking about? You know? So my decision in step three has only been ever made once. A decision is 1% deciding and 99% action. I take the action every day. I don't ask the same thing every day. I don't make that decision over and over and over. And so this all works. Step four is there to clean up my past. It helps me get into the most beautiful step. How are we doing? Okay. Step four is, and I'm just going to jump through some, is the most beautiful step. You know, I had to learn a lot of things in step four. There's 23 questions in this big book about it, and it cleaned up my past. First, I had to deal with my anger, my resentment. And I found out in the big book, there's only 5 things that ever triggered my anger in my life as I go through this book. And it's called the effects. Every time I feel the emotion of anger, I can take care of it right there. I do not have to get angry. Because the outcome of that, I get anger, then I feel the emotion of anger, then I get angry. If I don't do anything about that, I'll get a resentment. If I don't do anything about that, I'll get a hate. And if I don't do anything about that, I'll kill somebody. Or if it's internal, I'll try to commit suicide, which I experienced. And I got to tell you, anybody that you resent, to them, you're nothing more than a puppet on a string. 2 o'clock this morning, you think of them and they disturb your sleep for 2 minutes. They got you, and you think you got them, you know. And somebody talked this afternoon about the Lord's Prayer. And I remember resenting, and my sponsor's telling me, you really resent that guy? And he says, yes. So Max says, well, then you better quit saying the Lord's Prayer, buddy, until you get over this. Now, if you resent somebody, if you got somebody in the family that you don't like, that you don't want to talk to anymore because they hurt your feelings years ago, or they shamed you, don't say the Lord's Prayer. Because you resent them. Because in the Lord's Prayer, you're saying, God, treat me exactly as I treat those. Forgive me my trespasses as I forgive those who trespass against me. Have a bad day, buddy. Yeah, bang. Yeah, you're asking for it. You're going to get what you deserve. You're going to get what you asked for. So forgiveness is a big thing in this. So step four, I got through my anger. I got through my fears. I learned to separate my fears, my realistic and unrealistic fears. And I done that. And I looked in the big book and it says, go back through your life. Nothing comes but thoroughness, honesty. 85-90% of my 4th step is before I start drinking. All that stuff started before I started drinking. I added to it after I enlarged on it. The other thing it says here, and I remember doing my first 4th step, I start writing out my story. And it says it's a searching and fearless moral inventory. It's not a searching, fearful, immoral inventory. It says alcohol is but a symptom, so we don't need to write about our drinking. There's nothing in the big book about your drinking in step four. There's 24 questions in there to answer. We got to get down to causes and conditions. If I don't find out what caused it, then I'm never going to be able to deal with it. No use me saying I robbed a bank or shot at you. That doesn't help any. Why did I do it? You know? I have to find out those things. The other big thing in here, it says self-manifested in various ways had defeated me. And so my sponsor said, take a dictionary and look in the dictionary. I challenge you guys tonight. Take a dictionary, look in the dictionary, see how many definitions of self there is in there. You know, some of them have 300, some of them have 95. And you separate them, the negative self to the positive self. I was selfish. I had to become selfless. Get the definition, and I put selfish on this page, on this side, and selfless on that side. And watched myself over a month changing. And you can put a whole bunch of them down. So that I had to deal with myself. And then it got into the area of sex, and there I had some trouble. You see, I was a jealous young guy. I thought I was God. I thought I should have my own way. And ladies, I abused you. And I pray to God that justice will never be done for me. I pray for mercy. Because I was an abuser. Just the way I acted. I had to have my way. Not only that, I lied. I lied about you so that I would look good, okay? I'm not proud of that today. I want to share that with you, though. Because when I got up further on to make my amends, and I'm just going to jump ahead there, to make my amends, I remember this one little lady. I grew up with her. She was a great little gal. She trusted me enough to ask me to drive her home from a dance on a Friday night. Dances used to go till 2 o'clock. This is at midnight. She lived about a mile and a half away. I drove her home. You know, it took me over an hour to get back. All by myself, sitting there drinking beer so I'd have a story when I got back. That's how ignorant I was. And I didn't say anything about her, but when you said, what took you so long? And I said, don't talk about her like that. She's a nice gal. Innuendos, okay? So I started doing my step four, and that came out. And I looked at it, and I said, I owe her an amend. And I went and talked to her. And I said, I'm sorry, this is what happened. She said, I knew nothing happened. You knew nothing happened. But she said, will you go and tell my mom and my brother? Because you shamed them, Garnet. You shamed us in the community. And she was a widow. And so I learned something from there. It's not just the person that struck. What about those indirect amends, eh? That I went and shamed her mom and her brother and her sisters. And I went and seen Mary, her mom, and I explained everything to her and told her what I'd done. And she gave me a big hug and thanked me. And her brother thanked me. And how many of that did I do? I done a lot of that stuff. Beat some guy up at a dance and his family's there, and he wouldn't bring him to a dance anymore because this idiot is there interfering. I interfered in so many ways, not just, and you know it says in this book, when I make amends, you go to the person you hate the most. You don't go to your family till the fifth. The amends in the big book are divided into six different categories. Not one, but six different categories. And the first one is the guy that you hated the most, and it'll tell you what to do, how to get there, what you're supposed to say, and what you can expect. Then you go to the guy you owe money to. And then the criminal offense. And then you come down to the family. Okay? And the last one, and I had to do people that had died. And you hear a whole lot of things. It's so simple. It says in the big book, basically do it spiritually. If you would do the amend, if you could, it is done with a prayer. You do it through God. Okay? Not any other way. And it sure saves a lot of that guilt and stuff like that. Okay. So this thing is rolling along. We're rolling along here. This thing works. There's 12 steps to move me from where I was. And it's impossible for me to get from where I was to where I am today. You know, I couldn't do that on my own. And I thank God for all of that. Great things have happened. I got married. I got married 13 months after I was sober. What a hell of a deal, eh? I woke up this morning, she's still there. She'll be here tonight, you know. She'll be here tonight. But, you know, there's so many things have happened. I had that happen to me. I got involved in service in AA. I went from your GSR to your district committee man and all the way up. I become a delegate. And, you know, I have had the privilege of sitting on a couch with my arm around Lois Wilson. For you Al-Anon gals, 1982, my wife and I and my sister Opal and a delegate from California, Laguna Beach, she lived at that time, and a guy from Texas. And we went out to Stepping Stones, and everybody went into the house, and Lois had been sick, but she was there that morning, and three of us ran up to his little study. We studied up there. When everybody came outside, we went back into the house, and we had Lois with us. And we sat and talked to her. And I said to her, Lois, I said, have you got a copy of the original big book, like first edition? I've never seen one. Well, who do you think would have one? She's about that big, you know. She was all bent over. Who do you think would have one? And I said, I've just never seen one. So she says, let's go upstairs. So she took her little elevator and went upstairs. And we go up there, and she said, pull that box out. There was a table and a metal box, and I pulled that box out. And she opened it up, and she gave me that first book. And she pulled out the first book out of there, and in it was Bill's dedication to her that this is the first book off the press, that he dedicated it to her. I held that like I was holding something absolutely, I can't explain it. I still get goose pimples. I was holding something that saved my life. I said to Lois, I know this was printed or done in April. And she said, yeah. And I said, what day in April? I don't know, the middle of April, she said, when I got this. She's looking through it. She says, the 12th of April, 1939. And I began to shake because that's my birthday. Yeah, I just shook. So I got home and I was leaving there. And she said, is there Al-Anon in your, you know, connected with your groups at all? I said, yeah, we got a little gal, little Donna. She's having a hard time getting it going. She said, give me that serviette sitting there. She got it, or napkin, they call it down there. Give me that napkin. And she wrote a little a note to her. Keep it going, Donna. Love, Lois. W. And I said, I'm going to an Al-Anon gratitude night when I get home. Oh, she said. So she wrote to the district, DR, whatever you call it. And she said, are they going to be there? I said, I imagine so. So she wrote a little note to them and said, give this to them tonight or Saturday night on my behalf. So I brought her to her two messages back. And then her message is to you, every time you see Al-Anon people, she said, at a deal, tell them they're doing okay. So I passed that to you from many years ago to Lois, that you're doing okay, you know. And this little lady, I said to her, when you were going down the eastern seaboard with Bill, who was driving the motorcycle? Well, who do you think was driving it? The big lug was drunk, you know. Yeah. So I've had that opportunity, and I met the mother of AA. If it wasn't for her, AA wouldn't be around. Bill would have been dead. I met the mother of Al-Anon. And, I mean, I've met so many great people. I got trusted in my community. I got trusted for that. I also got involved in a few other things. I got involved in politics. My community I come from, when I sobered up, nobody trusted me. My mom and dad wouldn't let me in their house. I ran in a provincial election. I become an MLA. And the night that I won, I looked in that poll, my hometown, I got 84% of the vote. I lay down on the floor and I cried because they trusted me. They trusted me. And out of that experience, I had opportunity to meet a whole bunch of people. And I remember walking to the river that night in Thompson, and I wasn't singing God Save the Queen. And 12 years later, I'm dining with Queen Elizabeth, me and my wife, on two different occasions, you know. That's quite a move. And I'm sitting there thinking, why me? You know what? Why not? Why not? I came into this program hopeless, helpless, and useless. Good for nothing, full of hate, and wanting to die. I got in here, and I start believing, and today I'm a believer. I'm of no religion, okay? But I'm a believer. That happened again, you know? That love of God just give us all another heartbeat. I'm hopeful, helpful, and hopefully useful. I prayed before I start that I may say one thing tonight or this afternoon that has helped one person. If that's happened, I've done my job. I don't hate anymore. I love, and I love the right way. Women are not afraid of me anymore. They trust me, and that's big. And just before I quit, I want to talk about one quick thing here about forgiveness and about amends. First of all, I told you I got back with my mom and dad come back into my life. I didn't have to go and do 12 years in prison. And my dad one night was at my house, and I walked outside with him. He'd been having supper with us. And I really hadn't made that full amend because I had too much shame in me. And I said to Dad that night, I said, I am so sorry, for what I'd done and the shame I caused you and all of that stuff. And he hugged me and he said, my boy, you've become the man we've always prayed for you to be. We're proud of you today. You got a good wife and two good little children. Keep it up. You know, he was a very spiritual man. He said, I'll see you tomorrow night for supper again. I said, okay. We hugged each other. That was 8 o'clock at night. I'm just telling you this in case any of you are putting off amends. At 12 o'clock at night, there was a knock on my door. The R.St. Pierre standing there, and he said, are you Garnet? And I said, yes. Took his hat off, put over his heart. He said, we just found your dad dead in a car. He said, we want you to go out to your mom and tell her because he's 100 feet from the house. And I said, okay. Looks like, and he had a heart attack before, you know. And I thought, I left that amend to the last 4 hours of his life. Don't do that. Don't do that. I had no guilt after his death. You know, I felt good that I'd been able to do that. So reach out. It's not about you, but it's about God making room for you. There's a book. We have a book out, and it gives us a daily reading. On my birthday, it basically says that God can only do for me what I allow him to do through me. God can only do for you what you allow him to do through you. He'll control your heartbeat. It's like a tap. There's water pressure behind that tap. You can turn it off and be on your own. Okay? You can have a drip once in a while. You can let it run nice, or you can flush it and purge it. I thank God so much every day he's allowed me to purge and live. I couldn't have got here without his help. Thank you. God bless you.